This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. British actress Vanessa Redgrave is now in New York, performing off-Broadway in a production of Vida and Virginia about the relationship between writers Virginia Woolf and Vida Sackville-West. Redgrave also has a new autobiography in which she discusses her acting career, her controversial politics, and her illustrious family. Her parents were the esteemed British actors Michael Redgrave and Rachel Kempson. Her sister is actress Lynn Redgrave. Her daughters are actresses Natasha and Jolie Richardson. Vanessa Redgrave's own movies include Howard's End, Prick Up Your Ears, The Bostonians, Playing for Time, Julia, The Devils, The Loves of Isadora, and Blow Up. But much of her career has been on the stage. Early in her career, in 1961, she was starring in a production of As You Like It. Just before the first performance, the director, Michael Elliott, took her aside and told her the whole production was going to fail because she wouldn't give herself up to the play. I asked Redgrave what the director was trying to get across.
Supposing I'm talking to you and you're talking to me, and if I fail to give you my full attention, then I am already failing to give myself up to you, as it were. If I fail to give you my full concentration, I fail to give myself up to you. The same will be the case in the theatre, but even more so, and even more importantly, if a part of the artist remains guarded, trying to control, rather fearful perhaps, but it's not necessarily connected with fear, although there is a connection. It's, if you cannot give yourself up to what you have worked with, the other actors, and the whole play that has emerged as a result of the communal work together, there will be something obscure in the performance, and since in the case of As You Like It, it is entirely about a human release after a human imprisonment, not entirely metaphorically speaking either, and a rejoice in that release. That is why my Rosalind, if I hadn't given myself up fully to Shakespeare's play, the production, the other actors and its significance, it would have been a disaster.
What did you do differently that first performance than you had done in rehearsals?
I can't say. I only know that I went onto that stage, and as I stepped onto it, I suppose it was rather like deciding, all right, I'll fall off this cliff because the sea's below, but I don't know what's going to happen now. All I know is the sea is below. The sea was the play, and I jumped off that cliff, and the sea was also the audience, and I let that play speak through me.
I'm thinking that there were two really big risks here. One, it was very risky for the director to drop this bomb right before a performance as opposed to during the middle of rehearsals. And it was very risky for you to try something new the night of the performance as opposed to in a rehearsal when you'd have more of a safety net, when you could decide, you know, I'm giving too much here, I'd better draw back a little bit or tune it up a little bit before I actually do it in front of an audience.
Well, he had a very wise and thoughtful judgment, since he knew that if I didn't give up myself up to the play, it would definitely be disastrous for the whole production, for the play and for all the other actors. What could be lost? He had to go for the only thing that might make me release. And he did.
And that was what, a little bit of shock?
Well, it
Surprise.
Certainly was a shock.
Pressure.
Because I hadn't imagined him telling me that I was on the verge of making everybody have a disaster.
So is this your ambition? Did that become your ambition as an actress, to always just give your complete self and kind of jump off the cliff during a performance?
Well, I'd received some very important training by a wonderful singing teacher who was the coach at Glyndebourne until he died, called Yanni Strasser. I'd done a lot of work with him. And I've written about this in the book, and it's very important what he said. He said two things. First of all, singing is no different from speaking. You only sing because you are feeling and thinking so much that to speak it would be completely inadequate, an inadequate expression. You would not be able to communicate fully what you feel and think. So that was number one. And number two, he said, Think of singing in this way, that your body and your mind, you can say, are a team of poodles. They're very well trained, you've worked hard, and they've worked hard. Now, if you keep them on a lead and try and force them to do what you want them to do, they will do it very well. But if you let them off the lead, they will do something that is beyond what they've been able to do at that point and beyond what you can do controlling them. And that something other is what is required. And that is true. As if you can read a great writer, Charlotte Bronte writing about her sister's writing, you can read Virginia Woolf in the Common Reader series, part one, at the end, when she speaks of that other objective existence of a writing, a life, a collection of lives, an event which exists outside the limitations of each individual who's working collectively together. And that collective produces something that surpasses all the summation of the individual limits of those who are working to produce it.
Vanessa Redgrave is my guest. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Vanessa Redgrave, and she's written her autobiography. American actresses seem to be really at risk as they get older because there's so few roles for older women in American films. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why so many American actresses have been getting plastic surgery lately. I think they feel their careers would be ruined without it. And I'm wondering if you think the pressures are different in England.
No, they're not different in England.
You strike me as someone who's not succumbing to that.
Well, I'm not. I did have, in 1985, I had a thing because I'd got really bad bags under my eyes. That was 10 years ago, and I had that done. And after that, I'd had a very hard time at that particular period.
What an emotionally
hard time.
And
I was looking, and working very hard too. And I really did look very, very, very old. So I had whatever they call, you know, to lift the bags under the eyes. And after that, I haven't had anything done. And I don't intend to. I wouldn't say to anyone else they shouldn't. But the pressures are simply enormous. I mean, how could you say I get my hair dyed for all sorts of roles? I get it dyed in life. Whether I would if I wasn't an actress, I've no idea. It's pointless to speculate. I am an actress. It would seem to me absurd with modern science to not want to cure whatever defects you actually have. But then, of course, there comes a line when perhaps what are actually your own individual attractivenesses are made out to be defects by colour magazines and by publicity and commercials endlessly, endlessly saying only if you're young.
Intellectually, you understand the meaning of looks and what they can give you and what they can't. You understand the meaning of aging. But emotionally, when you started looking at yourself in the mirror as you began to get wrinkles, as you got a little bit older, did it upset you or was it fine?
No, it didn't upset me in the least. But I earn my living by making films and the theatre. And so I'm in the same situation, or at that time certainly was, that I had to take a course of action that would mean that I could do some more work.
Have you been getting roles that you've been pleased with? Or do you feel that age has been an obstacle for you in your work?
I don't regard age as being an obstacle for me personally, because at this point I am not terrified. Because at this point I have made up my mind that I, you know, even if I couldn't work, and I certainly hope to continue working in theatre and film, but even if I couldn't, I'll take my lot with all those other people in their middle 50s.
You've taken on many political causes, and you've campaigned for Palestinian rights, and that has made you a subject of some controversy, at least here in the United States. I think perhaps you've lost some roles because of it. Do you think that your career as an actress has been affected by the political causes that you've taken on.
Yes, certainly it has.
Let me try to put into words what I think is a popular conception about you. I think a lot of people see you as politically ideological and unbending, but as an actress, very complex, insightful, and open. What would you say to that?
I wouldn't say anything to it at all. Partly because, you know, political people have their own axes to grind who write in newspapers, whatever that axe may be. And if they feel their careers are on their line or their jobs are on their line, they might say things that they felt would make their job more secure. But that has never concerned me. What has concerned me is what I think concerns most people, is to try to give the maximum support as I can as an artist and a human being, whether of a practical kind or an artistic and cultural kind or of a political kind, where people have no rights, whether they're young or elderly people in my own country or in any other country, and most especially where they have been robbed as a people of their rights. Therefore, I have made and contracted considerable attacks from fascists because of the work that I do against those fascists who are now working all over Europe, who are attacking Jews, Jewish synagogues, who are attacking Muslim homes. And I put in a lot of work there with other artists, because I think artists can do quite a lot in that respect, not just to raise money. I will therefore put myself behind all the attempts made by artists in Sarajevo and outside Sarajevo to prevent Sarajevo being divided and to prevent fascism winning the war, because that's what the war is about, which Milosevic and Karadzic are leading with support from outside. I look at those questions and I feel now I see the connection with New York City or London or Birmingham, UK, or Marseille or Rome or Milan. I see kids who haven't got a decent education because our governments haven't, and state authorities and municipal authorities haven't put the money where it should have gone. I see kids who haven't got jobs. I see people's lives being absolutely ruined. I see elderly people in conditions that are hardly any different from concentration camp conditions. And I see the New York Times full of very, very, very thorough, very good reporting on these questions. That reporting, I think, is a plus in our world. I see the media, on the one hand, playing a big role in investigating and reporting on such conditions. And that's, after all, I'm a person who works in the media.
You're currently performing in Vita and Virginia off Broadway. Tell us a little bit about the play.
Well, Vita and Virginia has been organically and extraordinarily drawn out by Eileen Atkins from the materials, that is to say, letters and diaries of Virginia Woolf, who is a Picasso-like genius of the English writing, much unappreciated in England, adored in America, which is where I'm happy to make a comparison, that everyone in America knows Virginia Woolf, studies Virginia Woolf. You can get Virginia Woolf out of the local public library in Queens. And the philistinism in the United Kingdom is such that Virginia Woolf is paid lip service to. You'll find her photograph on the front of notepads that you get at a stationer's office or something. But the majority of people in schools don't know about her, don't read her, don't have the books to read. That is not the case here. Vita and Virginia is really about the love affair between Virginia Woolf and Vita Sackville-West. But it's as all love affairs, it doesn't begin and end on date one and date two. It began when they met, and it ended only when Virginia committed suicide.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Vanessa Redgrave has written an autobiography. She performs off-Broadway in Vida and Virginia through March 19th. This is Fresh Air.